You're listening to the Better for America podcast, presented by AMAC, the Association of Mature American Citizens.
Hello, everyone. I'm Rebecca Weber. This is your AMAC podcast, Better for America. Today, the nation is facing some steep challenges, and not the least of which is how we extract Americans from Afghanistan, especially in the wake of a catastrophic policy and operational decision. We could not have a better person with us today. This gentleman is more informed, compassionate, and resourceful on this topic. I'm so excited and happy to introduce a seasoned advocate for all of those in uniform, Congressman Rob Whitman. Mr. Whitman represents Virginia's 1st District and has since 2007. And real quick background here, Congressman Whitman served on the Armed Services Committee, or serves rather on the Armed Services Committee as vice ranking member, as well as ranking member on the Sea Power Subcommittee. He is also well known to our members as a believer in fiscal responsibility, sound national infrastructure, STEM education, and much of what AMAC stands for. Congressman Whitman, welcome.
Rebecca, great to be with you. Thanks for the opportunity to have a conversation with you and obviously with the members there in AMAC about all the things that are happening with this, what I would consider a debacle in Afghanistan.
And that is really where I want to go right away. We see, actually when we were setting up this whole interview, I was focusing on things like fiscal responsibility and the infrastructure bill. But we find ourselves today in a very different place. We're facing an unprecedented cascading national security and foreign policy failure in Afghanistan. We know thousands of Americans and 1,000 more Afghans who trusted and supported our military and our foreign policy priorities. They are at enormous risk. And the news only seems to be getting going from bad to worse with the Taliban in charge and America seemingly unable to effectively evacuate all of those in need. So putting aside the question of peace, timing, and our extended period in Afghanistan, can you help our members understand what is happening now and what it means in the near term and the longer term, and what might be done about this terrifying situation in Afghanistan?
Well, things are not going as they should. Let's go back to the beginning and how we find ourselves in this position. I think as you look at the main issue, and that is, should we withdraw from Afghanistan? I believe the answer to that question is yes. The second question, though, is how we withdraw from Afghanistan. Shouldn't it be conditions based? And that is, shouldn't we make sure that we are leaving behind some sense of order? Shouldn't we make sure in whatever agreements have been reached with the Taliban that they are holding up their end of the bargain? What unfortunately has happened is just a rush to leave Afghanistan by August 31st, regardless. And when that happened, what we've seen in the aftermath is chaos. What we've seen as U.S. forces have left Afghanistan is the Taliban taking over these cities, the Afghan National Army leaving those cities, the Afghan National Police leaving those cities. We see President Ghani, the president of Afghanistan, leaving the country. We see the Taliban taking over. We see now the Taliban controlling everything except that area inside the fence at the airport of Kabul, which creates this great chaos that we see today. The idea somehow that Americans can get out if they want to is specious. It is incorrect. It is not truthful. If you're an American somewhere in Afghanistan and Afghanistan's controlled by the Taliban and you have to get to the airport and everything outside the gate of the airport is controlled by the Taliban, that means that you are subjected to the mercy and the efforts of the Taliban, which are not good. The Taliban is merciless. They are not going to be friendly to U.S. citizens. So somehow the idea that you just present your passport and the Taliban are going to let you through is not what's happening on the ground. I can tell you that because I've talked to folks all throughout the weekend and what's happening there. In addition to Afghans that have helped the United States that want to get out because they know that if they stay behind, the Taliban will track them down and they will execute them, period. That is known because we've seen what the Taliban has done. So now where we find ourselves today is only the capability to move people once they get inside the perimeter at the Hamid Karzai International Airport, better known as HKIA. That's the only place U.S. forces control. To me, it's mind-boggling that, first of all, that we withdrew from every place except the airport. We didn't stay at Bagram Airport, which is a place much, much easier to control, that we now will not send in our special operations teams to recover Americans, which is really disgraceful because we've seen British special operations forces going in and getting Americans. We've seen French special operations forces going in and getting Americans, yet we will not allow, I say we, the administration will not allow our U.S. forces to operate outside the fence at the airport. So I think there are many things that are troubling. There are still thousands of Americans that need to get out. The administration doesn't even have a number about how many are left behind. They don't even have a number about how many Afghans are in that group of Afghans that have helped us that we need to help leave the country. You would think if you're going to go down this road, you'd have all this information at your avail. You'd think that you'd have some kind of plan, a contingency that if the worst case scenario happened, which indeed happened, in fact, I would argue it's even worse than the worst case scenario, you'd think you'd have a plan. There is no plan. There's not even the ability to determine what's the magnitude of the problem that we are facing. How many Americans are left there? And I've gotten calls, just hundreds of calls, heartbreaking calls over the last week of either Americans that are there. Many of them are missionaries. Many of them are there doing humanitarian work. Also of Afghan families who have given their lives to help Americans there and now find their family members or sometimes just themselves stranded as hostages in Afghanistan. And I say hostages because they want to get out, but they can't get out. They're trying to hide from the Taliban and trying to stay one step ahead of the Taliban. It's just heartbreaking, the things that we find ourselves facing today. And I believe every bit of it is avoidable. And Rebecca, let me do this and let your listeners know that it's not just about criticizing, it's about what should have been done and putting those things out there. But I also want to make sure we do the same thing as we did after 9/11, when we asked the question, how in the world did that happen? I put a bill in that would create an Afghanistan commission, the same as the 9/11 commission, to actually ask those compelling questions. What happened? What happened since 9/11 in 2001 to today? What's happened in the whole progress of what either has or has not happened in Afghanistan, and what has led us to this point? What has led us to this catastrophic failure in Afghanistan so that we can get the truth, so it's not political talking points, that we actually understand what happened and know what we need to avoid this from happening ever again?
Yeah. Congressman, you are truly an expert when it comes to our armed services. And even now, as this crisis continues to unfold, we're hearing that countries like Pakistan, China, Russia, Iran, and others, those with an interest in supplanting and upending U.S. influence in the world, are getting involved. So how do you believe this turns out, and how do you think this terrible misstep by the Biden administration will affect U.S. standing in the world and the ability to, you know, be effective in foreign policy ahead?
Well, I think it'll very much change what's happening in South Asia. And if you look at Afghanistan and look at the neighboring countries there, we should have, as a plan, had agreements with those neighboring countries to be able to at least operate out of those countries to keep terrorism or extremism from creeping back into Afghanistan. I argue that this creates a vacuum with what's happening right now. And that does mean that not just terrorist groups, but also these other countries will seek to influence what's happening in Afghanistan. And that will change the power balance in that region. And I would argue in ways that are not friendly to the United States. The Chinese are opportunist with their One Belt, One Road initiative that is looking to create links to all these countries, including Pakistan. They would like to be able to access, which they have already begun the very first steps in that process, to access the abundant natural resources in Afghanistan. Now, it's a very rugged country. It's a difficult place to operate. But believe me, the Chinese will do that. The Russians will also seek to influence that area as they did prior to the United States being there in their time to try to take over Afghanistan. We will also see other countries. Pakistan will push to have an influence there. I would argue much of the influence from groups like the Haqqani Network and the Quetta Shara have led to the destabilization of that country. And those individuals have gone after Americans. They're going to continue to do that, although Americans won't be on the ground there. They will continue to try to destabilize Afghanistan for their own purposes. You look at what's happening with Iran trying to expand their influence in the region. I believe Iran will probably try to do the same thing, not directly, but by proxies. We see Iran doing that around the world, especially in the Middle East, by sending proxies in. Think about it. The proxies that Iran sends in are terrorist groups. So you could see terrorist groups again trying to set up operations in Afghanistan. And remember, the Taliban before were the enablers for these terrorist groups. So we see all this uncertainty, whether it's major powers seeking to exploit Afghanistan strategically and economically. If we look at the efforts in extremist groups and terrorist groups to try to set up operations in certain areas of the world, Afghanistan now becomes a playing field for those extremist and terrorist groups, as well as an opportunity for major powers to exploit Afghanistan both strategically and economically.
Yeah, it's really a shame, because we recognize that we are emboldening the Biden administration. The way in the manner in which they've handled this really will embolden our adversaries, and we ought to be on guard and be ready to respond to those new challenges that we're going to face from those countries. I know that you're so focused on the Pentagon, future budgets and planning, and I'm sure that this Afghan withdrawal debacle will affect future oversight and appropriations planning, but I wonder if you could comment on the role that the State Department has played in all of this. Now, we were told that they abolished the CCR, which is the Crisis and Contingency Response Bureau, effectively the Evacuation Bureau. And that was just done in July, is my understanding. And that many in the Foreign Service also wrote a stinging dissent memo to the secretary when they learned that the withdrawal would be so swift. You know, we also learned that the president and secretary failed to coordinate with our closest allies. So what do you think should happen in response to this kind of failed decision-making? Should anybody be forced to resign, in your opinion?
Well, I think there needs to be full accountability within the State Department from the secretary on down. As we saw this massive emergency evacuation, almost exactly like we saw happen in Saigon years ago as U.S. forces pulled out of Saigon. Very, very disturbing to see helicopters landing on the roof of the embassy there, evacuating State Department personnel and other U.S. personnel there. The question has to be asked, how did that occur? And what happened within the Department of State where the advice and observations and directions from folks on the ground, in the field, those experts there, was completely discounted, and that they decided to go ahead in the face of this impending chaos and instability in Kabul that led to the evacuation of the embassy. Eliminating the CCR office takes away the ability for the State Department to even react with this. So again, now you have to cobble together a contingency plan at the last minute instead of actually having a mechanism in place to be able to respond when we have an emergency. You know, it's unfortunate. Why didn't we learn the lessons from Benghazi? You know, you think that we would have learned those lessons and say, yes, let's keep that in place. But no, it's taken away. The decisions made within the State Department, especially decisions that are made in complete counter to the advice that was given to them by individuals on the ground or people that have seen and experienced this and knew exactly what was happening. Why that advice was ignored, I think we deserve to know. I think folks on the Foreign Affairs Committee should demand a hearing, should bring the Secretary of State before the Congress to ask for a full accounting of what's going on. That's why I want to form this commission, because the commission is not limited to just what happened within DOD. The commission would include the Department of State. The commission would include the intelligence community, which also has said, listen, We told you that this was coming. We gave you the information to let you know what was happening. And there's a lot of counter in what's happening with the DOD community, with the intelligence community, with the folks within the Department of State. I think we need a full vetting of this to make sure that we can hold individuals responsible. And remember, this Afghanistan commission that I would want to create through the legislation I'm putting in would give them the full ability to get this information. It would give them subpoena powers. It would allow them to bring individuals in. It would be a bipartisan committee, individuals appointed by both Republican and Democrat sides of the House, or those appointed by the president, House and Senate, I should say, and the president, to make sure we have a full vetting. And it would not only include individuals that are elected. I want to hear from those folks that have been on the ground. I want to hear those folks that had that practical experience, not just a bunch of elected officials, you know, bannering back and forth. I think we ought to hear the information from those folks that saw it, that experienced it, and that knew what potentially was in the offing. And then to determine, where was there a breakdown? How did we find ourselves in this situation? And we ought to do that for the entire operational span that we were in Afghanistan. We know there was, billions of dollars that disappeared, that were wasted, things that could have been done differently. Those things we need to learn to make sure going forward, those things don't happen again. It's not about assigning blame. It's about holding folks accountable and making sure we understand, where did things go wrong and how do we make sure we avoid that ever again in the future?
Yeah, very, very smart, because we know that poor leadership costs lives and credibility. So these folks ought to be held accountable, and we stand with you on that, Congressman. I want to just, if you'll allow me, sort of focus a little bit more broadly here for a moment on the president's leadership. Now, he has conducted a series of press conferences where he ducks questions. He did it on Afghanistan. He's done this, it seems, since he's been in office. He was out of D.C. for an extended period during the crisis. He seems only half engaged, almost searching for words. He can't remember things, names, dates, policies. And we see bad policies continuing to emerge that are clearly problematic for the American people. Things like excess spending, no attention to inflation, a border crisis that is raging, record homicides in so many cities, continued efforts to push partisan policies, with no interest in unity, even though he spoke that he was going to be a unifying president. So I have two quick questions. Do you think we may be approaching a constitutional crisis surrounding President Biden's cogency or lack of mental acuity? Is that something that is, you know, our members ask us this. They say, they write in and say, you know, in fact, if you look at so much of what he's done, could we be approaching a constitutional crisis?
Well, I think that there's a deep level of concern about how disconnected the president appears to be from reality. And I do think that that question needs to be asked. Why is there that disconnect? Is it the people around him not giving him the proper perspective on things? Is it him just completely ignoring the folks around him? I don't think that that's the case. But again, I would want to know that. I would want to know if there's anything related to his cognitive function that would impair his ability to do the job. I mean, listen, I think we all have that responsibility. No matter who you are or where you are, people expect that you have the ability to perform the job. And when things are happening like we see, that seem to be so disconnected from reality, I think those questions are questions that need to be asked. And listen, they're brought up from time to time about the president, about his ability to function in a very stressful and high level job such as the presidency. I think folks across the nation expect that, regardless of where you are on the political spectrum, you expect the president to be able to perform. And if there's anything there that calls that into question, I think that those questions need to be answered. So I think in this particular situation, as you said, as you pointed out, the litany of things that are happening, whether it's economically, whether it's at the southern border, whether it's in Afghanistan, whether it's at the crime rate, whether it's, you know, what's happening with this massive increase of debt, with these spending bills that just go off in these extreme directions. I think all those questions need to be asked. I know I've had a lot of calls and questions this weekend from constituents just along those same lines. The constitutional questions that are at the basis of what the president is required to do under the Constitution. And those questions, I think, do need to be asked. They should be asked of any president in making sure that this country is under the proper leadership in relation to the capability of the individual that holds the office and the ability. So if there's anything that impairs that, and we've seen these questions come up in the past, so it's not unique to President Biden. They've come up with presidents in the past. And I believe that we have a responsibility to make sure that we understand those issues, if there are some with the president. We understand, you know, what's surrounding that. And if there is anything that impairs the president's ability, I think that we ought to know that. Obviously, the cabinet members, those closest to him, know that. And they also have an obligation constitutionally if something stands out to them where the president can't perform. But I also think, too, that the administration has a responsibility, if those questions come up, to be able to answer those questions instead of just discounting them, or instead of separating the president from being able to answer the tough questions. I think that cuts right to the confidence that this nation has in the individual in the Oval Office.
Yeah, very good point. And here we are, we're so focused, we're almost riveted on this heartbreaking failure in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. and the terrible withdrawal operations. But there seems to be a tendency in Washington to keep pushing bad policies and spending when people are distracted. So I want to turn to the infrastructure bill. Can you tell us what you think may happen with the infrastructure bill or bills, which separately and together seem to contain excess, unneeded, and largely unwanted spending? So my question is, will either of these bills become law? And if so, is there any way to keep them focused on real infrastructure like roads and bridges and ports and airports? Or must America suffer another bout of what seems unnecessary spending and going to drive inflation and really jeopardize the middle class? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, sure, Rebecca. Well, listen, first of all, I think we do need to make the investment in infrastructure, but infrastructure only, and not this expanded definition of infrastructure that the Democrats want to put in place. When I will be returning to Washington this evening, we will begin the voting process on the Democrats' budget, which has that massive $3.5 trillion of additional reconciliation bill spending. Does not include the infrastructure bill that passed the Senate, but this is their first step to include that massive amount of additional spending that is essentially a progressive wish list. Now, I can tell you that there are going to be people on their side of the aisle that have said that they will not vote for that. So I think Speaker Pelosi is going to have a very challenging time to get the number of votes just to get the rule passed so they can begin to consider the bill, and then enough votes for final passage. She has already said that she will not bring the infrastructure bill to the floor unless they pass this budget and reconciliation package together. But folks on the other side, the moderates, have said, we're not voting for this budget unless you bring up the infrastructure bill first. And then the progressives have said, we will not in any way, shape, or form support an infrastructure bill unless you get the reconciliation bill passed. And there's been a thought that, well, there'll be enough Republicans that'll join the moderates to vote for an infrastructure bill to where you won't need the progressives. But I don't believe that that number is clear to the speaker. So I think she's going to have a very, very difficult time. I think that members on her side of the aisle are beginning, some of them are beginning to see the outlandish way that they are going about this massive increase in spending. I mean, with the things that are not related to anything that are needs of this nation and that add to the national debt, that add to the deficit. And those things do make a difference. They absolutely do make a difference. For those that say, oh, no, don't worry about how much money we borrow, you know, we're approaching $30 trillion in debt. I can tell you that does have an impact on our economy. It does have an impact not only on us, but it has an impact on our children and our children's children, because they're going to be footing the bill to pay this money back. And it will affect the economic stability that they face into the future. So I think the speaker is going to have a very, very challenging time. I can tell you the folks that I talk to across the first congressional district are highly concerned about getting back to fiscal responsibility, especially in light of all the spending that's taken place with COVID. Now, listen, some of those things we needed to do, but some of this additional spending that's occurred in this last quote-unquote COVID-19 relief bill were completely unassociated with COVID. In fact, there are still over $1 trillion left out there of the money that's been appropriated that's unspent. And in the last bill, they actually have a five-year window in which they want that money spent because there's so much, you can't spend it all at one time. And as I said, the vast majority of it are for things unrelated to COVID. So where we're going with this massive amount of irresponsible spending, with adding to our deficit, with spending money on things that have nothing to do with the needs of the nation, but have everything to do with the wants of the progressives in the Democrat Party, is where we find ourselves. And unfortunately, if they're able to get this passed, it will not only be today's generation, but it'll be the generations to come that will have to foot the bill for this.
Yeah, and it really is plaguing America. You said it, $30 trillion national debt. It's an unimaginable number. But as Americans are watching Congress spend and spend, their own gas prices are up, lumber prices are skyrocketing, food at the grocery store has spiked. Biden has been pushing more and more spending. So how do you advise Americans to handle the rising threat to their own financial security, especially folks like our members who have saved so long and are finally just spending down maybe some of their retirement? You noted recently that inflation has increased every month since Biden has taken office. Is there any way, you know, short of the 2022 elections, to send a message loud and clear to Congress to say, stop this runaway spending? We're doing a lot here at AMAC, but I want to hear you encourage our members. What can we do, average American people, do?
Absolutely. Well, I encourage your members to call their members of Congress, both House and Senate, and implore them to stop this irresponsible spending that's adding to our debt. And remember that massive amount of spending contributes to inflationary pressures, because when you dump this much money into the economy, it is going to inflate the costs of everything, from fuel to goods and services. Everything is going to see a spike in these costs. And when that happens, all of a sudden your money doesn't go as far. So if you're on fixed income, you look at what comes in each month, and the cost of living all of a sudden now is much greater. And we all know that the cost of living adjustments and things like Social Security never keep up with what's really going on with inflation. So therefore, it puts people in a position to have to make some really tough choices. You know, do I buy food this month? Do I buy medication this month? I mean, those are very heart-wrenching decisions that those individuals have to make when their dollars don't go as far. So I would encourage your members to call their members of Congress, to implore them not to spend these additional dollars, which we know will add to inflationary pressures, to do things in Congress to make sure we are alleviating these inflationary pressures. And that is making sure we're making good economic policies, making sure that we're getting people back to work. You know, these incentives to encourage people to stay home are not what we need to get this economy growing. I've talked to businesses each and every day. In fact, on Sunday, we went to a restaurant that had a sign on the door that said, the labor shortage is real. We only have 3 servers today, so please be mindful that it will take you much longer to be seated and much longer to be served. And we see some businesses are just truncating hours. They don't have people there. So instead of being open from Monday through Saturday, now they're open Wednesday through Saturday. So we're seeing that across the spectrum. That also shrinks the economy. That creates even more inflationary pressures, because remember, when there are fewer goods and services to go around and the demand stays the same or goes up, what happens to prices? The old law of economics, we know prices go up. So I want to make sure that your members encourage their members of Congress to do the right thing, to make sure that we are not going down this path of this irresponsible spending on things that are unrelated to the needs of the United States. These may be based on the wants of the progressives in the Democrat Party, but not based on the needs of the United States, and to make sure we manage that spending to just those things that we need, and to make sure that they encourage members of Congress to enact policies that actually allow our economy to continue to grow, not to stifle our economy.
Yeah, thank you. That's a great reminder. And to anyone listening, it's very, very easy to find out who your representatives are in Congress. Simply go to the AMAC website, look under the Tools and Resources page or button, and it'll bring you. You type in your state, your address. It'll tell you exactly who and, you know, contact information, email address. All of it is right there. You can do it right from your smartphone. So thank you, Congressman Whitman, for that excellent reminder, because we do need to ensure that our voice is heard, and we do that here every single day at AMAC. People know how they can get involved, and we're getting very much involved to ensure that the voice of those people who recognize that runaway spending is bad for America, that voice reaches the people who matter. I want to thank you so much. You have been a real gift to our members today. You're so candid, clear, experienced, and principled. And we appreciate all that you are doing to hold our government accountable, both at home and abroad. And you've given us a lot to think about, so we really do appreciate your leadership, Congressman. I want to thank you. I hope to have you back with me.
Well, thanks again, Rebecca. We look forward to coming back on the show. And thanks to all your members. Thanks for your members staying plugged in. I would encourage every one of your members to be active. This is your government. It doesn't belong to those that you've elected. It belongs to the people. And our government works best when the people demand that their government be accountable and that it do the things that are in the best interest of the nation.
Thank you so much. And to every AMAC member out there listening, thank you for tuning in. If you have not downloaded the AMAC News app, you can do it. You can watch, listen to today's podcast and get news that you'll never see anywhere else. We don't take an email address. You don't have to pay for the app. It's free. It's simple. It's great. So please make sure to hit the subscribe button, follow, like, and share wherever you are on social media. Until next time, I'm Rebecca Weber. This is your podcast, Better for America. Thank you so much for being here, and God bless you. Have a great day, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the Better for America podcast. To learn more about AMAC and all it has to offer, visit us at www.amac.us.